Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Andrew Tink makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here, I think, on two occasions before, and on this occasion, following the publication of Air Disaster Canberra, the plane crash that destroyed a government. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. He served as Shadow Attorney General and Shadow Leader of the House in the New South Wales Parliament. He's the author of two books, William Charles Wentworth, Australia's Great Native Son, and Lord Sydney, The Life and Times of Tommy Townsend. And on this occasion, Andrew Tink has turned his attention away from biography to look at straightforward history of an important period in Australian history and politics. And so the topic for tonight's talk is Australia 1940, the air crash that killed a government. Andrew Tink, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gerard. Look, first of all, I make this explanation everywhere. I've had radiation for throat cancer and I'm going well, but my mouth gets very dry, so I have to drink from this bottle. There's nothing wrong with me and there's nothing wrong with the bottle. It's got water in it, not alcohol. So go okay. Well, Air Disaster Canberra. You might think that politics in Canberra today is in a tumultuous state. Let me say it's nothing compared to what politics was like in the national capital between 1939 and 1941. In April 1939, Joe Lyons, a long-serving conservative coalition prime minister, died, and his immediate replacement was the leader of the Country Party, Earl Page. And Earl Page accepted a commission to be prime minister on two conditions. The first was that as soon as the UAP selected a new leader, he would stand down as Prime Minister. The second was, if that UAP leader happened to be Robert Gordon Menzies, he'd stand down from the ministry. The UAP ignored this threat and went ahead and elected Robert Gordon Menzies leader of the UAP. And so, still Prime Minister, Earl Page went into the chamber and unloaded on Menzies, accusing him in effect of cowardice for having failed to serve in World War One, and for that reason, Page argued that Menzies was not fit to be Prime Minister at a time when another war was clearly looming, talking of April 1939. Menzies got through this attack. He was resilient, but this attack really knocked him about, and he got through it in part because he had three very great friends in the Parliamentary Liberal Party, and they were Geoffrey Street, James Fairbairn and Henry Gullett. And all three of them under him became very senior ministers. Fairbairn, Minister for Air, which is to say Air Force. Gullett, Vice President of the Executive Council, which did not reflect his true heft within the Cabinet. And Geoffrey Street, Army Minister. And they were Menzies' Praetorian Guard. When he was attacked for not serving, and he was attacked not only by Earl Page, but by Tommy White, another very prominent Conservative politician, a World War One fighter pilot, Richard Casey, for so long as Richard Casey remained in the Parliament before being appointed to Washington, Casey attacked him, and others. These three ministers held him up and helped him to remain in charge and in control. Menzies declared war on Germany, and I was always interested to read that. Menzies did, in fact, declare war on Germany in September 1939. And for a year or so, the war was in a phony phase, as they say, in Western Europe, until the Nazis turned their attention to the Western Front. And then, of course, France collapsed very quickly. At about the time the Battle of Britain was getting underway in earnest, we're talking August 1940, The Defence Department was based in Melbourne. Canberra was still a very tiny place, only about 10,000 people lived there. And the view was taken that the Defence Department shouldn't be moved to Canberra and create all that turmoil. But the Parliament, of course, met in Canberra by that stage, and cabinet meetings were held there too. And so what would happen is that the ministers responsible for defence would spend their time in Melbourne at the department, and then they would come to Canberra for cabinet meetings. And this was the position on the 13th of August 1940. Street, Gullett and Fairburn were at Victoria Barracks in Melbourne, and they joined a VIP flight, which happened to be a Hudson bomber converted to civilian use, for the flight to Canberra, where Robert Gordon Menzies and others were waiting for them to hold a cabinet meeting. The plane had an uneventful flight until it reached the outskirts of Canberra. A number of people were waiting for it. Being a VIP flight, there were a number of people waiting for it at Canberra Aerodrome, and there were farmers out around Queanbeyan and various other places. And many eyes saw this plane circle Canberra twice in a left-hand direction, lining up for the runway. Well, not the runway, no runways in those days. It was an all-over airfield, but lining up to land into a westerly breeze, which meant the final approach came over Queanbeyan. And then, as the plane dropped height, it was noticed that the left wing dropped. The plane appeared to go into a spiral dive and went straight down from a height of about 1,000 feet, crashed, burst into flames, and everybody on board was incinerated. 10 victims in all, and it remains, in terms of lives lost, it's still Canberra's worst ever disaster. The fallout from it was immediate. Menzies personally was devastated. He was a tough character. He'd been an outstanding barrister at the Victorian Bar as a constitutional lawyer. He had a very high opinion of himself, not without good reason, and he handled himself pretty well on most occasions and in most circumstances. But this tragedy just knocked the wind out of him, and he was quite distraught about it. The funerals were held, and then the public at large largely forgot about it, because the war had entered a new and dangerous phase, and mines were elsewhere, and lives were being lost all over the place, and planes were crashing all over the place. But a long fuse had been lit politically, which was to burn away for the next 2 years, and ultimately to burn away a Conservative government. Three by-elections had to be called, because each of these ministers were in lower house seats. But Menzies approached the Governor-General, Lord Gowrie, who, with the general election due in only a few months' time anyway, decided to grant him a general election. And the election was called for, I think it was September 1940. In Henty, which was the seat which had been held by Sir Henry Gullett, Arthur Coles, the Lord Mayor of Melbourne and the man, one of the people behind the Coles retailing empire, decided to stand as an independent. But because he was a Conservative, Menzies and the UAP elected not to stand anybody against him, and so he was elected fairly easily in Henty, and in the other two seats, UAP candidates were elected. But Menzies had campaigned unevenly in the 1940 election. He was still out of sorts with the tragic crash and still grieving for the loss of his friends. And the end result was a hung parliament, where the balance of power was held by two independents. In those days, there were 74 members of the lower house, 36 coalition members were elected, 36 Labor members were elected, and two independents. Arthur Coles and Alex Wilson was re-elected as the independent member for Wimmera, a Western Victorian rural-based seat, basically. A bit of argy-bargy took place, as you'd expect, and as we saw following the last federal election, where Rob Oakeshott and Tony Windsor and others made various declarations to the media and then made their choice. Well, the same sort of thing happened in 1940, and as a result, Menzies and the coalition retained power with the support of the independents. And Menzies did his best to conduct a wartime government at a time when there were pressures on him to pay attention to the Japanese threat And at the same time, there were pressures on him to contribute forces to the defence of the British Empire, or more particularly to Great Britain itself, which was literally at that stage fighting for its life. So he was under these pressures too. And I think that the combination of all these things started to get to him. And unfortunately, within the coalition party room, and I regret to say this did happen within the coalition party room, it wasn't a particularly Labour thing. John Curtin had never served in World War I either. There was this constant backbiting about Menzies not having served. So concerned did Coles get about it that after a while he joined the parliamentary UAP and became a signed-up member in the party room and provided Menzies with support that way. But after a fairly controversial visit to London, where Menzies stayed for about, I think it was 5 months in late 1940-1941, and actually joined the British War Cabinet for a while. People here were saying a Prime Minister shouldn't be in the UK. He either's got to elect to be a member of the British War Cabinet or be the Australian Prime Minister, but if it's the latter, he's got to be in Canberra. All these pressures were playing on him. And at the end, when people like Harold Holt, who had supported Menzies, and John McEwen, who was also a supporter of Menzies, started to say, listen, we think you need to reconsider your position, and of course both those men later became Prime Ministers themselves, Menzies, after taking advice from his wife and his father-in-law, who'd been a Victorian Member of Parliament, was now a Federal Minister without portfolio, Senator Leckie, Menzies decided to step down as Prime Minister. And Arthur Fadden, the leader of the Country Party who'd acted as Prime Minister while Menzies was in London, was elected to take his place. Coles was incandescent about this, furious, believing, and he said it publicly, that Menzies had been lynched. Even though Menzies had resigned and made that free will decision, Coles was in no doubt that it was under duress and force. And so he stormed out of the coalition party room and went back and sat on the crossbenches, and he bided his time. As Fadden put it, famously, he lasted 40 days and 40 nights as Prime Minister. And when he introduced his 1941 budget, John Curtin moved an amendment to reduce that budget by £1, which is in effect a no-confidence motion. And Coles, after the debate had gone on for a day or two and everybody was getting a bit sick and tired of it, suddenly dramatically stood up and announced that he was backing Curtin's motion. And then Alex Wilson got up and announced following Coles that he too was backing this amendment by Curtin. And as a result, the government lost the vote. Fadden went to the Governor-General, handed in his commission, and recommended that John Curtin be sworn in as Prime Minister, which, of course, as you all know, happened. And that's the only occasion on which an Australian government that I know of has had its fate determined on the floor of the House by the vote of two independents in a hung parliament. I think Tony Abbott's got something similar in mind for the 14th of May or thereabouts. We'll see what happens. So far, this is a unique circumstance. And my view is that, but for that plane crash, Menzies would have remained Prime Minister throughout the war. Because I think it's fair to say that Pearl Harbor would have happened, that Menzies, with Cole's support, would have survived until Pearl Harbor, and that once that event was passed, the public would have got behind him as the threat to Australia became immediate and very obvious. And so I actually go a little bit further. I'll go a little bit further in this company and say that not only did the crash lead to Curtin becoming Prime Minister, but as I thought about it further, it actually inverted the probable sequence of politics after World War II. I think if Menzies had remained Prime Minister throughout the war, it's unlikely he would have gone on much longer after it, and there's likely would have been a change of government then. I've often thought who would have been the Labor Prime Minister. I'm sure it wouldn't have been Curtin, even though he became a very fine war Prime Minister. Personally, I think it would have been Burt Evatt, but possibly Ben Chifley. But the post-war arrangement of politics seems to me to also have changed as a result of this crash. So that's, to me anyway, the fundamental importance of this event. Now, the other really interesting point in this story is, how did a plane like this come to crash? We see the Prime Minister, we see the Leader of the Opposition catching VIP flights all the time. And I think it's reasonable to assume that the RAAF keeps these planes in good condition for obvious reasons, just like the American government keeps Air Force One in good condition for pretty obvious reasons too. The planes are maintained, the pilots are competent, and things should not go wrong on such flights. So how was it that something went wrong in wartime Australia in 1940 when Britain was fighting for its life and we suddenly lost our key war leaders? There are a number of inquiries into this crash. There was a coronial inquest in Canberra. There were two Air Force inquiries, and there was an inquiry conducted by Mr Justice Lowe of the Victorian Supreme Court, sitting as a special Air Force tribunal. And a number of witnesses were interviewed many times, and that created its own problems. And there were two jurisdictions as well. The ACT police interviewed everybody who saw the crash from Canberra, and the New South Wales police interviewed everybody who saw the crash from Queanbeyan. There were issues. Unfortunately, too, the RAAF took control of the crash site. Canberra Airport was closest to the crash site, and the crash happened on a ridge right beside Canberra Airport. And the RAAF got there first and put a cordon around the place and controlled it to the exclusion of the police. As a result of which, no forensic photographs were taken of the victims in the wreckage, a practice which had been commonplace in New South Wales since about the 1920s, wherever a murder or a suspicious death was occasioned, photographs would be taken of the deceased. And also, there was no tagging of the bodies in place either, such that they could be taken to the morgue later with a diagram of where the body had been found in the plane and then identified later on. And I should say it's not obvious that the bodies were not identifiable immediately by visual observation in the plane. So what had happened? What did these inquiries find? Well, the plane was a brand new plane. It only had 7 hours on it. It was a Lockheed Hudson. There are a number of them based on the Lockheed Electra, which was a famous aircraft to civilian use before the war. It had been very well maintained. It had been strictly under guard at Laverton in Victoria. It was specifically converted to VIP use. All the bomb racks and so forth that you'd normally find in a Hudson were taken out, and it had 6 passenger seats. And it also had dual controls, most important in this story. Two places where a pilot or a co-pilot could fly the plane without changing seats. The captain of the flight was Flight Lieutenant Bob Hitchcock. Bob Hitchcock's an interesting guy. His father, also called Bob, had gone in search of Kingsford Smith when he and Ulm had crashed up in northwestern Australia in 1929, so some said for a publicity stunt. Well, Bobby Hitchcock and Keith Anderson went looking for these people, and they thought they'd crashed in the Tamanite Desert. In fact, they hadn't, but Bobby Hitchcock and Anderson crashed in the Tamanite Desert, and they both perished from thirst. When Bobby Jr. was approached and asked whether he wanted money for his family, he said, "This isn't what Dad wanted. I won't accept any money. Us boys," he spoke like that, "will look after our mother on our own." Well, you can imagine Kingsford Smith suffering a little bit of a PR problem by this time, going allegedly deliberately missing in the outback and then being found, it all being a stunt to get publicity and so forth. Kingsford Smith's name was not held in high regard. And the new hero was young Bobby Hitchcock. And so his local member, John Curtin, said, "Lad, what do you want to do with your life? I'll see you can do it." And he said, "I want to be a pilot, Mr. Curtin, in the RAAF." And so it was Curtin who saw to it that Hitchcock joined the RAAF and, in the opinion of some, was advanced beyond his capabilities, because his file was marked with the magic words, "Son of Bobby Hitchcock, who died in the Kookaburra looking for Kingsford Smith." And with that on his Air Force personnel file, Some said he got a lot further in the Air Force than his skill and merit said he should have. So he had various crashes in planes. There's one fellow still alive in Canberra, a retired group captain, who remembers going down in a plane with Bob Hitchcock. And he had a bit of a reputation as a tricky pilot. But here's the thing. When he was transferred to Hudson's, he managed to fly 107 hours as a captain, incident-free. I've looked at his logbook in the National Archives, been through it very, very carefully. He flew for 107 hours incident-free. And his squadron leader said he was, when cross-examined later, said he was a slightly above average Hudson pilot. And to put that in perspective, there were probably only about four or five Hudson instructors in the entire country who had flown longer than Bob Hitchcock on Hudson's. He'd done the Canberra run before, and he landed the Hudson in similar conditions, coming in over Queanbeyan and over that little ridge. So when the inquiries were held and sabotage was eliminated, the aircraft being unworthy was mechanically unsound was eliminated, and all these other possible scenarios were eliminated, the various courts found that pilot error was to blame. But Justice Lowe and others had terrible trouble trying to conclude that Hitchcock had been flying the plane. They really, I think, could not marry up his record in Hudson's with what had happened on what was a pretty reasonable flying day. Nevertheless, the blame was attached to Hitchcock by default, in the sense that it was just said the air crash was caused by pilot error, and that was accepted. But there were two other pilots on the plane that day. One was Richard Weissner, who was a pilot officer, an outstanding young pilot, but still very new, and he was not certified to fly Hudson bombers. And so he was on this flight only as an observer. And then there was the Air Minister himself, James Fairbairn, one of the most distinguished pilots in Australia. He was a very distinguished World War I fighter pilot on the Western Front. He was licensed to fly 25 different types of aircraft at the time of the crash. He'd flown a plane from London to Melbourne in the mid-1930s, which was no small thing in those days. And last but by no means least, about a month before the accident, he had flown a plane around Australia in a time which allowed him then to hold the round Australia airspeed record. So Fairbairn was no slouch as a pilot. And he'd made a statement during a ministerial visit to a school in Adelaide about a week before the accident. And I'm going to read it out to you. It's quite long, but to me this is absolutely fundamental. Speaking to this headmaster at the school, who was also a pilot, they got to talking about Hudson's. And this is what Fairbairn said. Hudson bombers have a rather nasty stalling characteristic. The combined effect of throttling back and dropping the flaps preparatory to landing can land you in a whole heap of bother. They're very sensitive at this stage to varying air pressures, and from what I've been told, a pilot coming in to land can find himself suddenly and without warning in a machine that's no longer airborne, heading straight for the ground. I will be using a Hudson for my departmental travelling, and on every possible occasion I'll practice landings and find out about this stalling trick. Personally, I think it's only a matter of handling your throttles wisely. Now that, to my mind, is a clear statement of intent, whether admissible or otherwise in inquiries. I'm an historian now. I'm not appearing before the federal court or anything of that nature. To me, that is a very powerful statement of intent, admissible or otherwise. What I think happened was this, and there are a couple of other pointers. Herb Plenty, who I mentioned before, still alive, retired group captain, very distinguished pilot. Herb Plenty recalled years later speaking to the Lord Mayor of Melbourne, who during the war had been Bob Hitchcock's squadron commander of this VIP flight. And Sir Frederick Thomas, as he then, by this time, became said to her plenty, you know, I told Hitchcock to let the minister have a touch of the controls. That's the second point. The third point was that one of the people who attended the scene soon after the fire had been put out was in fact a Canberra fireman called Tom Hines. And Tom Hines was moving through the wreckage and tripped over what he thought was a log. And when he looked again, to his horror, he discovered it was a body. And then he said later, something about this body convinced me that the wrong person was flying the aircraft. So these things, to my mind, all add up as against the relative improbability of a pilot with 107 hours up crashing a Hudson in those circumstances. So here, and the other thing I should mention is this, that when they went to take off from Essendon Airport, they taxied out to the end of the runway, which in a Hudson means that you've got two large landing wheels under the main wings and a tiny little wheel at the back, so the plane sort of going out this like a DC-3, you know, with a nose up. Hard to see into, and no one could really tell from the ground who was sitting where, as this plane taxied away. They get to the end of the runway and they stop for 10 minutes. The fellow who's in the tower has got a number of trainers. Essendon was a training aerodrome. There are all these people learning to fly to go off and defend Britain and so forth. They're all buzzing around the place in little planes. And he gives them what was called the red light. And the red light is from the control tower saying, you stay up there, do not land. All your sort of landing calibrations and so forth and timetables are hereby cancelled. You stay up there until the red light goes off. You can imagine a guy in a tower with all these students running around is acutely aware of time. So he's timing it. This plane is sitting there for 10 minutes. Then it moves a little further and it sits there for another 5 minutes. And then finally it takes off. So what do I think happened? What I think happened is this. Hitchcock was on the left-hand side in the pilot, the captain's seat. Weissner was on the right-hand side in the co-pilot seat. At some point, while the plane was still on the ground, Fairburn went forward, tapped Weissner on the shoulder and said, I'm going to sit here. You can't fly this plane, with meaning to say you're not qualified to fly the plane. I'm just going to do what you're doing. I'm going to sit here and observe. So Hitchcock gets himself into the co-pilot... Fairburn gets himself into the co-pilot seat. People ask, well, what would the Army Minister have said about this? What would the Vice President of the Executive Council have said about this? What would the Chief of the General Staffs of Brudden or White have said about this? Because they're all sitting in the plane. My answer to that is nothing. Because Fairburn would have said, I'm going to observe... And they all knew that Fairburn was the go-to guy as Federal Parliament's pilot in the 1930s. The only guy with a current licence, Dick Casey, I think, was trying to get his back. But he was the only one with a current licence at that time. So he gets himself into the co-pilot seat and then works on Hitchcock, who's described by his instructors and his superiors as an old soldier type. That's to say somebody who does what he's told, especially by somebody like an air minister. And basically, Hitchcock let Fairburn fly the plane. And all was well until they made their approach to land. Now, all these planes Fairburn was used to flying were of an older type where they had gliding characteristics. In other words, on approach to land, you could ease off the throttle and let the weight of the plane to some degree bring you down, which is, of course, the way modern planes land too, to some extent. But that's the important point, to some extent. And that was what Fairburn was used to. So you could come in fairly low, fairly slow, and make a shallow approach. Not in a Hudson bomber, you couldn't. The Hudson bomber was a high-performance plane. It looked big, it looked bulky, it had tapered wings, it was very high-powered, it had two 1,050-horsepower Pratt & Whitney engines. It was a monster in its day. And it had what they called a high wing loading. So the weight of the plane was high compared to the area of the wings. Cut a long story short, you couldn't glide the wretched things. So you had to land them hard, you had to land them fast, and you had to land them from a high angle of attack. I went up in a Hudson bomber in Tamora in November last year. It was the most exciting hour of my entire life. Well, that might not quite be true, but it's right up there, let me tell you. And they fly them like fighters. And it was interesting, they told me a story down there about a Zero pilot, which is, say, a Japanese fighter pilot who'd been caught by the Allies, and they were asking him questions about various Allied aircraft, of course, to get some intelligence, and he said, you know, one of the funniest things that happened to me, I saw a Hudson bomber lumbering along one day, and I was up there locked and loaded and ready to go, and I tried to line up behind him to shoot him. I couldn't shoot him down. He was ducking and weaving and going like this. I could not line him up to shoot him down. And that was what these Hudsons, so to speak, brought to the table as a... they weren't fighter bombers, but they almost had that characteristic of their time. And unfortunately, I think what happened was Fairburn attempted to land the plane, going back to automatic, so to speak, landing as if it was a plane that he was used to flying and not this new high-performance plane. And the irony of it is that what he told the headmaster is a better summary of what I actually think happened than anything Justice Lowe or the wing commanders or the other people or the coroner in Canberra ever wrote about the final moments of this flight. Fairburn, in a spooky sort of way really, had nailed it a week before the crash had happened. And I went and stood up on top of this ridge, which is right beside Canberra Airport. If you know Canberra Airport, you've got Pialago Avenue running along the end of the runway, the north-south runway, and you go down a hill and you come to the Sutton Road, which sort of leads back up towards the Hume Highway. And this ridge runs parallel to the Sutton Road on one side and the main north-south runway on the other. It's not very high. You can climb it easily. I stood up there with the transcripts of evidence and a compass and sort of tried to work it all out and get it sorted, knowing that the memorial that's there, by the way, is right on the site of where the plane was found. And it seems to me that what happened was that Fairburn came in too low, too slow, got to a point where he had his, I won't say, oh, dot, dot, dot moment, and what am I going to do? I'm not going to clear this ridge. So he does, and this is what the Hudson guys told me they would have done in that situation, the guys who fly this plane into Mora. Your instincts kick in, you ease the nose up, and you put the power on to climb over the hill, so to speak. Well, in a Hudson, that's fatal. That is actually fatal, and the manual warned that if that was what was attempted, then the plane would do a left wing down stall. Left wing, I don't fully understand this, left wing not in the political sense, but left wing because of the way the propellers cavitated, and it would push this type of plane down to the left. And that's what happened. There's some suggestion that when this happened, Hitchcock finally, for his own self-preservation, I guess, grabbed the controls, and no doubt by this stage, from whatever little time they had left, literally a second or so, Fairburn obviously would have let him do that, and almost managed to land the plane in some sort of Herculean feat of piloting. And indeed, there's a theory that the plane landed largely intact. And what got them was that unfortunately they went over the top of a log, which ripped off the undercarriage and burst the fuel tanks and burnt them. But there's an intriguing photograph of the plane in one of the newspapers of the day, which is in the book, showing the plane in an upright position. And you can see, although the wreckage is burnt out, that you don't get a sense that the plane has been catastrophically destroyed. Rather, it's been burnt out. So it might, at the end of the day, have been a fairly close thing. So that's the story of the Canberra air disaster. And I did dwell on who was flying because Anne, you marketed it that way when I got my email. Who was at the controls?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Many thanks, Andrew. We've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. So Janet Grundy's got some copies of Air Disaster Canberra, the plane crash that destroyed a government. It's a lovely produced book by UNSW Press with some great photographs, and so you've done well. Just before we go on, tell us a bit about, I suppose, the best known people on the plane were probably the politicians. I happen to meet, I think, a son of each of them. Fairbairn's son was Geoffrey Fairbairn, the academic at the Australian National University with strong anti-communist debates in the 1960s. Street's son was Tony Street, the minister in the Fraser government. And Gullett's son was Henry Gullett, the backbencher in the Menzies government. But I guess these were... Joe Gullett. Thanks, Anne. In the Menzies government. But I guess these guys, we think of them, I suppose, as old. It's a long time ago. But I guess they were relatively young men at the time. I mean, what kind of personality was Fairbairn that he would want to do what he did? Well, and what about the personalities of the other guys?
Despite what I say, to me, Fairbairn's a great hero. And I'm at pains to say that in the book. Fairbairn was... a thrusting guy. I say he was a Douglas Fairbanks Jr. lookalike, if any of you remember Douglas Fairbanks Jr., which is to say a very handsome man with a moustache. He was a very brave man. He was severely injured in World War I. He was in a group of fighters, and his plane developed engine trouble and, as he said, dropped revs, and he had to pull away and head back towards his own lines. And a number of German fighters came after him. He turned to face them about three times and shot a couple down. And finally was shot down himself after he was severely wounded in the arm, which affected him for the rest of his life. When he hit the ground, as he said, the plane had its nose to the ground and its tail in the air, which was his position as well. He said something like that. He set fire to his plane so that it wouldn't... fall into the hands of the enemy, and then he realised he was caught by his seatbelt, at which point a German infantryman came by with a knife and cut him free just in time. He then was taken into captivity where the enemy were very admiring of the fight he put up and gave him a bottle of Johnny Walker Scotch to drink, which staggered him, and gave him Three Men in a Boat to read by Jerome K. Jerome, which I thought was wonderful too. That should give you an idea of who he was, you know, as a fighting man of action. And that's exactly what he was, a fighting man of action. He was somebody who was right at the forefront of technological developments. Even though he couldn't fly a Hudson, he knew as much as just... Well, he knew more than anybody in the Parliament, that's for sure, about flying. He'd developed aerodromes right around the country. He developed radio beacons right around the country as Air Minister and Civil Aviation Minister to make flying safer for people. And he had this sort of questing, risk-taking nature. And he was behind the controls, I think, because he wanted to know about the Hudson. He wanted to know what the pilots who were flying under him as Air Force officers had to contend with. So his motives were pure and his intentions were good. And to the extent that you have, you know, feisty get-up-and-go people in cabinet who are at the forefront and the cutting edge of things, he was one. And he just blew it on the day. Now, catastrophic results, but I don't mark him down hard for that. And that may sound bizarre to you, but I think I'm a lawyer by trade, and I think lawyers have got a habit of going and sitting in armchairs after the event and judging people harshly. I don't think that should be done to Fairbairn. At a time when, of course, everybody was taking risks, and he was asking people to take risks on the front line in air forces, because Australians were flying in various different air forces at that time. So that's Fairbairn. Street, Minister for the Army, previously Minister for the Defence, Menzies' closest supporter, still a young man like Fairbairn, they were still in their early 40s. He had been educated at Sydney Grammar, fought in World War I, a distinguished career even though he got on the wrong side of Pompey Elliott, in my opinion Australia's greatest fighting general of World War I, but basically mad as a cut snake. And Street got on the wrong side of him. He used to say of Street that he was an eastern suburb socialite who had to go to bed in his trench in silk pyjamas. And, you know, he used to get furious with Street, who was a keen cricketer, because Street had, whenever there was a lull in the shelling, it go out and they'd level off a piece of ground behind the front line and play cricket. And that used to annoy Elliot as well. Street wasn't as politically ambitious as Fairbairn. Fairbairn had been a young nationalist when Menzies was leading the young nationalists in the 20s. Street came through the Hampden Shire Council. He'd moved to Western Victoria by this time through marriage. But he won Corangamite, I think it's called, the federal seat. And perhaps because he was a little quieter than Fairbairn and a little less outspoken, but nevertheless very able, he got ahead and got into the ministry first. And so Street was one of those guys who I would say a gentleman, not a cut and thruster like Fairbairn, not quite as get up and go as Fairbairn, but nevertheless extremely competent. And as Malcolm Fraser later said of his son, he was one of those people that you could give any job to and he'd just get on and do the job quietly and do it competently. So I say in there, like father, like son. So Henry Gullett was a fascinating guy. He was born in what the Americans would call a log cabin, but highly intelligent. And he was a wordsmith and became a journalist and reporter and was in England, I think, when World War I began. And after enlisting, he was earmarked by Charles Bean, the legendary World War I war historian, to be a war correspondent. And he ended up as a correspondent covering the AIF in Palestine, which became Volume 7 of the official history of World War I. And as Bean said himself, in his opinion, Gullett's Volume 7, the AIF in Palestine, was the best of all the volumes that were written of that conflict. And Gullett was the first of them to get into federal parliament. He was a minister in the 1920s. He was trade minister at various times. He's a bit highly strung, but again highly intelligent. And he developed the habit as trade minister of flying off the handle in trade negotiations so he could get better outcomes as a negotiator. And they used to call him Hustling Henry. That was his nickname. And he was the oldest of the three. He was 63, and then 62, I think. And then there was Brudnell White, the chief of the general staff, a lieutenant general in World War I, responsible for planning the evacuation from Gallipoli, an outstanding staff officer, in Monash's opinion, the greatest Australian general out of World War I. That's really saying something when you think about it. Had gone into retirement after the war, and then been recalled to duty by Menzies after the death of his predecessor through cancer. And White said himself that he thought he was too old to be chief of the general staff. He thought his time had passed. He was thinking like a World War I officer. He still thought in cavalry terms, when the German army was laying waste Western Europe with the Blitzkrieg. But he was a very learned man, White, and again, another incredible loss to this country. So they're the main fellas.
Thanks. We have a policy at the Institute of not forgetting political staff. I think one of the ministers had a staffer on board, right?
Yes. Yes, there was a fellow called Dick Elford who was the private secretary to the minister for a year.
They always go down. Okay, so...
What about this?
Hang on. Oh, right, sorry. David. Yeah.
So what about
Wiesner? Well, Wiesner's another interesting fellow. He was the son of a Macquarie Street doctor. He went to Shaw. Something seemed to happen in the Depression. He was just of an age where the Depression hit that particular group very hard. And he ended up working for Australian Iron and Steel in Wollongong. There was some family connection down there, which struck me as being a little bit below his ability, perhaps. But he studied accounting and then he went to America to better himself and understand the steel industry and so forth. But he also became a pilot, and when World War II broke out, he volunteered, and his true ability became apparent. He topped his class and was earmarked for, the very best the RAAF could offer, which ironically is how he ended up on this Hudson. He, of all the group that were attached to number 2 squadron, this VIP squadron, he was the first one of them to get up in a Hudson. And he'd been up for 1 hour, just standing behind the pilots, as I did when I went up last year, just stand there, chocked in the back of the cockpit, watching them. And he did that for an hour. And it was just literally, I think, the next day or the day after, Hitchcock came into the staff room and said, whatever it's called, the officer's mess or something, and said, I need somebody to come up with me tomorrow for this VIP. VIP flight to Canberra. Wiesner, it better be you. And that's how Wiesner came to be on the plane. But he couldn't fly the Hudson. So he was a great loss. war produces great losses, but you know, of all the people, say, who had potential on that flight as a young person, he was probably the greatest loss. All the stories were tragic. Dick Elford, the private secretary to Fairbairn, was a young man, young married man, and just celebrated his wedding anniversary. Charlie Crossdale came from your area, Robin, up in the Hunter. He tried for years to get into the Air Force and had been knocked back, amongst others, by Street, who was then Defence Minister. One of the things about the Air Force was, even though the machines were fairly simple by modern terms, you had to be technically good to be involved, even as ground crew, and he didn't quite make the cut. But he kept applying and applying and applying, and finally they gave him that slight advantage, and he got in just ahead of a few other people, and of course that's what killed him, ironically. There was a fellow called Palmer, who was the wireless operator. Similar story. He'd worshipped Charles Ulm. He was a Qantas boy. Apparently that was something that you were as a boy interested in flying in those days. You were a Qantas boy. All that sort of thing. And he also got a little bit ahead of the pack in that sort of rush to join the RAF, which is why he was on the plane. There was a fellow called Colonel Thornthwaite, who was actually related to Geoffrey Street. He was a very distinguished World War I officer, but unlike Street, who'd become a brigadier, by the way, in the militia between the wars, Thornthwaite had tossed it in to be a grazier, and he'd been recalled to duty and was a lieutenant colonel. But in my opinion, you know, with his record from World War I, had he lived, he's the sort of fellow that could quite easily have become a general officer fairly quickly, as some of the others did. So this is a, you know, story of great tragedy. But, you know, as I say, in war there were tragedies going on everywhere, which is why the public forgot about it. But the political consequences were and still are unique in our history.
So it's Richard, and then we go to Robert. Yep.
I'm wondering whether the inquiries had interesting information about the investigation. It seems that the forensic work that wasn't done at the time was absolutely fundamental to a failure to come to the sort of conclusion that you've come to. Was there discussion by the inquiries about that?
There was, and perhaps I've been a little bit harsh on Mr. Justice Lowe, but it just strikes me that he cut questions off. Sorry, that's not quite right. He and the counsel assisting asked leading questions when it came to questions of identity and what might or might not have been done. And they seemed designed as leading questions to cut off that line of inquiry. Now, I'm not saying there was a conspiracy or anything like that, or that Menzies had got in their ear. I'm sure that didn't happen. Lowe, from all I know, is a fine, upstanding man and a very distinguished judge. But for whatever reason, and you judge it for yourself, tried to reproduce some of those transcripts because I think they're important. It just strikes me that there was just this... they pulled their punches, frankly. Pulled their punches. One of the assessors who was on the bench with him, a fellow called Group Captain Carr, I think it was, Lowe sat with two assessors, asked the critical question of one witness, you know, was Fairbairn at the controls, could you see? And that was another question that got cut off quite quickly. So these were things that really quite bothered me. To be fair to Lowe, I'm not sure that the evidence was there for him to affirmatively say that Fairbairn was flying. One thing that irritated me was that the reason why we know the conversation between Fairbairn and the headmaster was because the headmaster was so disturbed about the crash and the aftermath that he wrote this letter to the inquiry. This is his letter to the inquiry. And he got a reply saying, well, this will be considered by the inquiry. It never was. That's another thing that irritates me as a... admissibility questions there may have been, but nevertheless there was just absolutely nothing done about it. What could Lowe have done? Well, I think he could have been a bit fairer to Hitchcock, which is to actually say, I think who was flying the plane's an open question. Mind you, that would not let Hitchcock off the hook. There's one iron rule, as I understand it, and that is the captain of an aircraft is the captain of an aircraft. If you're the President of the United States and you've got an Air Force colonel flying your plane, you can't go in the cockpit and tell him to do this or that. I mean, you know, tell him to fly to Hawaii rather than Alaska or something, obviously. But, you know, in the critical phases of a flight, or you cannot interfere. The captain's word is law. And so Hitchcock lays himself open to criticism, if the theory is correct, for letting Fairburn have the controls. That is an error. Either way, Hitchcock cops it. Either he cops it because he let Fairburn fly, or he cops it because he crashed the plane himself, so he doesn't get off. But personally, I think it's open that he may not have been flying.
So hang on, David, we're going to go Anne and then Robert, OK?
When you describe your admiration of Fairburn, I take your point in terms of war and everything else, but it seems to me it's a characteristic of the time. A, air travel was very dangerous.
It was.
But B, can you imagine any minister of the Crown today being a hero because he practiced landing an aircraft with a whole lot of important people on board? I mean, if he went up to the IAAF Air Base and had a bit of a fly around in a new aircraft and crashed it, well, okay, but he had a whole heap of passengers on board, so it was utterly irresponsible, and he wasn't, you know, playing war games. What was the compensation for the people who were killed? I mean, nowadays it would be a huge compensation case. What happened?
I haven't covered that in detail, but a lot of them struggled, and I'm not at liberty to say this because it was told to me in confidence, but I know the family of Bob Hitchcock, because a couple of them have approached me since the book's come out, struggled dreadfully in truly shocking ways. And again, you know, the whole nation was at war. I mean, you know, compensation, it just not something that was handed out. And these people were sort of in effect killed on active service in a way. That was how it was sort of seen up to a point. But there were, you know, the New South Wales Registrar of Births, Deaths and Marriage refused to believe for about a year that Thornthwaite had died in the plane. He refused to grant probate on the New South Wales part of Thornthwaite's estate. You know, some bizarre things happened.
Robert, it doesn't seem to be appropriate to use a Hudson for this purpose, particularly at this time. Surely it would have been better to retain it as a bomber. Were there particular reasons for choosing the Hudson for this purpose? And what was the reputation of the aircraft among contemporary pilots?
The reputation was that it was very high performance but very tricky. And in fact, Howard Hughes had flown one, and there were so many problems with stalling that they introduced wing slots, which are actually slots right through the wing of the plane to change the distribution of the air over the wing to reduce the stalling characteristic. At that time, they had what they call Fowler flaps. Now they're just called flaps. You know, you're sitting near a window. Sitting on a window near the trailing edge of a plane. You come into Kingston Smith or something, you see these great things go down towards the end. Well, they were new on this plane, and they dropped down like massive boards. Later on, they were stoppered to stop them going beyond a certain distance. So the Tamora Hudson, the flaps are stoppered at 60%. So some degree it was experimental as well. I guess the assumption was that the aircraft in the hands of a competent pilot was good to fly, and it was, and it is. The hour I had up in Tamora, the guys flew it like a dream. Although interestingly, they don't like landing it near the crowd. Perhaps I shouldn't say this. I went down on a flying. maybe I shouldn't say this. They like to land it over on the other runway. Not because they're going to crash it, but just because the landing's something a little bumpy at times. But it's tricky, and that's what gives it its performance. I said to them, "Will you take it up to 10,000 feet for me and do a left wing down stall for me?" And they said, "No, we're not going to do that, because that what happens is the plane actually flips on its back."
Cool.
And so, well, you know, 10,000 feet, you've got plenty of room to recover. And they said, "Yeah, but the airframe's 80 years old." I had to sign a waiver. They made me sign a waiver before I went up that was about that thick. And then these guys, there's a photo of it in the back flap here. Very proud of this photo. You know, the boys turn up with their flying kits on and crash helmets. And I say, where's my crash helmet? They said, no, you get a set of earphones. But they let me have the run of the plane. They said, you've got to be strapped in for takeoff and landing, but you can walk around other than that. And they let me go up on the dorsal gun turret, which was astonishing because you're actually sitting up above the plane and you're taking photographs forward over the top of the fuselage. So it was a fun day.
Stuart.
You touched on this. Take away David Day's fanciful idea that Menzies went to England to supersede Churchill as Prime Minister. But do you think that the reason why Menzies stayed there so long was to get away from the backbiting that was going on in Australian politics at that time?
That sort of thought momentarily crossed my mind, to the extent that, you know, people in Parliament or people under stress or whatever, you know, do act in strange ways from time to time. Maybe that was on his mind. I think more substantially, though, there was a lot of work to be done in England. I mean, that was at a time when England was fighting for its life. You know, Japan was not in the war at that time. The Battle of Britain was on. By the time Menzies went over, the worst of the Battle of Britain was past. But it was still an exceptionally dangerous time. And there was the ongoing issues about the deployment of troops in the Middle East and so forth. And Churchill ran roughshod over his cabinet. Churchill's cabinet was a one-man cabinet. And Menzies could see the deployment of Australian troops coming up for discussion, where there was a bunch of yes men, and they were all men, a bunch of yes men just nodding their heads, and Churchill would have his way. And so Menzies fought hard over issues like the deployment of troops in Greece, the deployment of troops in Crete. Now, those campaigns at the end of the day were not what you'd call successes, but I subscribe to the view that they were very important campaigns for the outcome of the war, because as later became accepted, I think, those Greek and Crete campaigns slowed up the German army. They diverted key elements of the German army to go and fight in southern Europe, and so delayed for some critical weeks the German invasion of the Soviet Union. And, you know, well, you can go on and on about hypothetical history, but, you know, there's a school of thought that says those lost weeks, if the Germans had invaded a month or 6 weeks earlier or whatever, maybe, possibly, the Russian result might have been different. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is he was doing serious business, even with the advantage of the hindsight of, what is it, over 70 years now. He was doing serious business in Britain and had good reason to be there. Was it politically smart for him to be there or be there so long? No, it wasn't. And his wife and his father-in-law were both cabling him to the extent that they, and this is one of the problems, that they could cable him because there were security issues, obviously, about what could be said in cables. But as best they could, they were cabling him, saying, for heaven's sake, get home. You know, your backbench is white-anting you. And they were, and they did, and it wasn't only the backbench, it was also the ministry. And in fact, you know, when Menzies decided to throw the towel in, I think it was the case that a majority of his ministry was saying, look, you know, you should move on.
And we're running right to the end, so we've got a final quick question here from Dave.
Yeah, very quick. From what you saw of the geography of the interior of the plane, would passengers have been able to tell whether it was being flown by the person in the left seat or the right seat?
I spent a lot of time on that. The Hudsons that were photographed at that time had a door which separated the main cabin from the cockpit and the next area behind it, which was where the wireless operator sat. So there was a door, and the door was closed. I can't say the door was closed on that plane, but that was yes. That was the normal procedure. So then I go up in the Hudson in Tamora last year, and they sat me in the wireless operator's seat. So I'm sitting immediately behind the pilot on the left-hand side, the captain on the left-hand side. And what struck me is that even though I'm inside that area, on the inside of the door, so to speak, on the pilot side of the door, I still couldn't figure out what they were doing. Because behind the seat of each of them was like a metal partition. Not a metal partition that blotted out the whole of the cockpit from that vantage point, but one which was a backing to each of their chairs. And so the opening is in the centre. And the photo I've got through the cockpit window is at Banks is through that center. But it's still quite hard to see who's flying. And I'm not sure it would have been apparent. I mean, I went up in a Cessna the other day and we flew over the crash site at Canberra. And I won't say who I was with, but and I realised, I was sitting in the back, and I realised after a time that the person on the right hand side of the seat was actually flying the plane, when I thought it was the person on the left hand side. So if you go looking for it and you actually turn your head and sort of sit, you know, become quite peculiar and uncomfortable to look around, you can see who's flying the plane. But if the assumption is, you know, that there's nothing wrong with this flight, you know, the wireless operator we know was sending regular wireless signals. There was a constant stream of wireless signalling going back and forth. He was busy doing his thing. And I don't think anybody noticed or would have noticed. He could have, but he would have had to have sort of, in effect, gotten up from his seat and sort of craned his neck around.
Andrew, many thanks. No, we've got to stop. We're right on time.
Can you easily access the site anymore?
Well, there's a question. Can you? How do you access the site near Canberra Airport?
The one where it crashed.
You go along Pialago Avenue towards Queanbeyan. As you come down the hill from the ridge, there's a sign that says Air Disaster Memorial. It's a turn to the left along a dirt track. You take the car as far as you can past a paintball rage on the right and a dirt speedway on the left. Both disgraces, in my opinion, in that location. And drive as far as you can, and then you start walking sort of diagonally up the hill to the left. You come to a chain link fence which separates that area off from the Madura Field firing range. Follow the chain link fence a kilometre up and down two hills. Make a sharp right-hand turn down a fire trail and it's right there.
How long does the walk take?
Great for a picnic.
Yeah, how long does the walk take?
Depends how fast you walk.
No,
I don't know.
You, how long does it take you?
Oh, I don't know. A
couple of hours?
Oh, no, God, no, no. Maybe 20, 25 minutes.
Okay.
So depends on whether you get lost.
Okay. Many thanks, Andrew. We could go on all night, but we won't. It's always great fun at the Sydney Institute. We've had a very important historical lecture tonight, but also good advice about to take your crash helmet if you go up in a Hudson any time. So I'll remember that.
And ministers should be very careful flying in large numbers in one plane.
And ministers shouldn't fly in large numbers in one plane. Nor should they fly the plane, I suppose. As I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of Andrew's book. I think in this 100th year of Canberra, there should be much more done there to access this site. It's a very important historical site in Australia. Some very fine Australians died there. As Andrew's made very clear, it's not easy to access, and so many people don't even know this site exists. But tonight we've had a significant talk about an important period in Australian history in 1940 and the impact that had. So we're very grateful for Andrew for doing the work and coming along to the Institute tonight and talking about it. Well done. We'll see you back at the next project.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.